Hello, and welcome to our series, Career Resilience, where we talk with people about their career path and their career journey, and maybe we can all learn from each other. My name is Jan Daniluk, and I'm a human resources professional in London, Ontario, Canada. I work with Ford Keast LLP, and I work with my clients to help them with the HR side of their business. We hope that you will enjoy these discussions with real people about real challenges and real working life situations. Welcome. My guest today is Dan Peetens. Dan, welcome to Career Resilience.
Thanks for having me. Super excited to be here. I've been looking forward to this for a while. Thanks, Jan.
Oh, that's a wonderful thing to say. I'm in the same boat, actually. I've been looking forward to chatting with you. Now, you are an artist in London, Ontario, Canada. What do you call the type of art that you create?
Most people will call it photorealism or hyperrealism. I've given a few talks to some art classes, virtual art classes, of course, in and around London, Ontario. And the teachers always describe it as photorealism. I don't like to call it that, because when I think photorealism, I think it's got to look exactly like a photo. But I try to render elements in my pieces that try to give away that it's not a photo. So I call it pseudo-realism.
Pseudo-realism. Okay.
That's what I call it. Yeah. I'm not trying to coin a term or anything. No. It's just how I've always identified it.
None of it sounds as romantic as I think it is. Your work is absolutely amazing, and we're going to be chatting about that. And I wanted to thank you for your work, because it's the kind of work that when people look at it, they go, oh my gosh, that's just so amazing. And it's wonderful to have things in life that you look at and say, oh my gosh, that's so amazing. So thank you.
Gonna make me blush right off the start. This is one of the things in my life that I've always just pursued very selfishly, you know, for myself, just to bring myself my own joy or relief. Yeah. And the fact that other people want to see it, you know, let alone have it in their home, it honestly blows me away. It really does. So thank you for saying that.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about your art, but we're also going to talk about some struggles that you've had. And so let's go back and take a look at the kind of jobs that you have held over the years. Can we sort of start there with your pre-art career?
Sure. How far back do you want to go? I've got a laundry list of them, you know, going back in the high school days and working the way forward.
Well, let's talk about a few of them, maybe sure. After high school.
Yeah. So I my goal ever since grade 7, when I sprained my thumb, was to become a physiotherapist. And all my life, I had people saying, wow, it's so good that you know what you want to do. So, you know, my son or my daughter has no idea what they want to do, and they've already got a degree. And I took pride in that, knowing what I wanted to do. So every step I took going through university or even through high school, to be quite honest, was to become a physiotherapist. So when I finally graduated with my master's, it was off to the races, jump into that. And I'm sure we'll talk about the struggles I had and what led me away from physio. But after physio, I looked at a few other occupations. I became a web developer. I even went back to school, got my diploma in that. I was a digital specialist for Fit for Less. Good Life Sister Company. I was obviously, you know, now an artist, and I was a professor at Fanshawe College, teaching in the occupational therapy assistant, physiotherapy assistant program, among a few other small things here and there. So long laundry list.
So of all those jobs, what was your preferred?
Definitely currently the art.
Right, 100%. But previously.
Yeah, previously, definitely a professor. I've also been a volleyball coach, competitive volleyball coach. Not an occupation, it's a volunteer position, and I absolutely loved it. And so when I had the opportunity to teach in a different capacity in a different discipline, I really, really did enjoy that too.
You went for your master's. What was that in?
That was in physiotherapy. So master's of physiotherapy from Western.
Okay, so here you are going along, always knowing that's what you wanted to do, and you started working in that field. So what happened with that grand plan?
going through the program, you have to do these practical tests, right? Pretty much any occupation that requires you to work with a patient or whatnot, you have to prove that you're able to, you know, have a competence in the area. So you do these practical tests, and we're all super nervous doing them because we're working on a person. And so I would always go in, I'd have a lot of anxiety, but I'd always be able to fake it. So people would always comment like, wow, I couldn't believe how calm you were. I was so nervous. And I'd tell people I was shaking in my boots the whole time. But I always thought that was just because I was faking it. And I knew that. And that anxiety came with, you know what, not really knowing how to do what I was doing. But when I got into the profession, working with live patients, my own patients, I still had a ton of anxiety. I would perform all kinds of different compensation behaviors trying to get through the day. And I kept telling myself, maybe this is going to change. Maybe when I just get better at this occupation, I'm going to have more confidence in what I'm doing. But as time went on, my anxiety just increased for a whole bunch of different reasons. And so it got to the point where, you know, I went from full-time to part-time to casual to a couple of patients. And then finally, I just said, I got to get away from this. You know, I was becoming very, very unhappy. I was becoming very, very depressed, taking it all out on my wife. You know, she said, you got to do something because we're not going to last if this keeps going. So she's been very supportive in allowing me to pursue what is going to make me happy.
So here you are in a profession you had chosen, realizing it didn't work for you and it wasn't working for you. So how did... I know that you said that you knew you had to get away from it, but you were on a path that you had been planning for so long. Were you proud of yourself when you said, you know what, even though I've been on this path, I know it's not for me?
I think all the initial reactions were ones that prevented me from leaving, you know, even in the first year. It was actually a lot of shame. The physiotherapy world professionally is actually quite competitive, and it's a very, very small world, especially in the private physiotherapy sector. And so it's a hard thing to admit to yourself and to others, this isn't what I wanted to do. And for a while, it really did feel like a failure. You know, again, I went through my whole life priding myself, knowing what I wanted to be. And then all of a sudden I had to look in the mirror and say, you were wrong the whole time. You didn't take the time to really investigate what the profession was about. You didn't take time to learn about yourself, to see if it was right for you. You just fell in love with the idea of a profession and accepting failure has always been very difficult for me. So I had to do that first. I had to say, listen, though it's not really a failure, you made a mistake. Mm-hmm. And you spent a lot of money doing it. Your parents spent a lot of money helping you, but it's not right for you. And so there was a lot of shame that went with that. But finally getting out of it immediately, you know, I had no money. I had all this debt. even at that point, there was a weight lifted off my shoulders that I definitely felt good doing what I felt was going to make me happy, or at least taking the next steps, even though I was wrong time after time after time again. I felt good and had a sense of calm knowing that I was going to be pursuing something that would eventually make me happy.
So even though you were wrong time after time after time, what does that mean?
that's a good question. When I say I was wrong, I was trying to find what was going to make me happy. I really admire people out there that are able to go to their job that they admittedly say they do not like and perform at an adequate or even above adequate level and provide for their family, making the money and go home and enjoy their life. I have so much respect for those people. That's unreal. You know, I consider my parents very much like that. They had an idea, or at least their perception of what a job was totally different from myself or what others I've talked to believe it to be. You know, I think we're living in a generation, you know, us millennials, where we think you can be whatever you want to be. And the job that you have is really entwined as to your own success. Where I think the generation prior, it was a job to provide for your family. Didn't matter what it was. and live your life outside of that. Yeah. But I truly believe in myself and the way that I think this is me, you know, my life and how I live it and how I enjoy it is really intertwined with my own occupation. You know, yeah. I don't like the idea of spending 8 hours out of my day doing something I don't want to do and really not enjoying those 8 hours every day. So for me, it's always been very, very important to enjoy what I'm doing.
So you left physiotherapy and you went into technology by the sounds of it, various aspects of technology. So how did that work for you?
Well, when I was in high school, you take those aptitude tests in careers class. And I had two recommendations when I finished that, I don't know, 100 long question test. And it was either graphic designer or it was physiotherapist, believe it or not. I'm pretty sure I didn't answer fully honestly a lot of those questions, which is why it said physio. But I think the ones I answered honestly on came back as graphic designer. But and I've always loved drawing. I've always loved doing art. But a lot of people told me, you don't make money as an artist. Don't do it. You'll never be successful. And I genuinely believed it. It was never on my radar to pursue anything art related. But when I came out of physiotherapy, I made a lot of connections. And especially in the private sector, physiotherapists are also entrepreneurs. We run our own businesses and we link up with people and we contribute to other businesses. So I ended up creating a lot of websites for different people, including myself and my own businesses I was trying to start. And I was generally proficient at that, as well as a lot of other things that I choose to become obsessed with. I become quite proficient in them.
Okay. So
I learned to develop websites along the way. And I also really did like the sort of sprinkling of our artistic outlet that was within that, designing websites and designing logos. And so I thought, maybe this is what I should do. I like coding. I like designing websites. So maybe this is what I should do. And that's when I got into the digital specialist position at Fit for Less headquarters.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how long were you in that role?
About a year.
A year?
Yes.
You decided to leave after a year to go where?
To really nothing. Really nothing. To backtrack a little bit, when I came into physiotherapy, I decided to go back to Fanshawe to get my internet applications and web development diploma. But that was also the same year where they went on strike. The part-time staff there. Mm-hmm. So we had the choice to withdraw and receive all of our money back or to sort of defer, put it on hold and come back. Now, at the same time, when this was all going on in that first year, I had applied to Good Life and ended up getting the job through them. So I made the decision to leave web development, at least the schooling for it, pursue them. But later on, when I left that position, I decided to go back to school and finish that web development diploma. So during that time, as I was back in school, my 2 years there, I was running my own web development business.
And where in there were you happy?
I wouldn't say I was ever really happy in those positions. I was always very excited at the prospect of starting something new. You know, you have that anxiety, the exciting anxiety of starting a new occupation. And I really was excited at the prospect of being happy and really being a part of a team. And I thought it was going to happen. But then, you know, as time goes on and some of the novelty wears off and some of that excitement wears off, you're left with the true perception of what you're in.
And how did that manifest itself on the job? Were you able to perform the job?
I was able to perform. So on the surface, I think that a lot of my coworkers in those positions would attest to this. I believe I performed very well. But my own perception of how I was doing, to me, it always came across as very inadequate. I would have to use a lot of my sick days. You know, I would wake up on some days and be super depressed, couldn't get out of bed. I'm very, very anxious of going into work to the point where I'd be sick to my stomach, you know, quite nauseated, where I would actually be sick. And, you know, I'm taking a sick day, but, you know, it's also a personal day at the same time. You know, I didn't have a cold or a flu or anything, but I always managed to get all my work done. Never really underperformed. But in my own perception of my own performance, I felt like I was underperforming.
Did you have an excessive number of sick days?
Yeah, I used all of my sick days and then some. Absolutely.
And did anybody ever speak to you about your absenteeism?
Never. I always made sure, but me in my own anxiety tendencies and what I have, I would always bring it to the attention of my supervisors, whether it was my direct superior or whoever it would be above that. I just said, I want to let you know, I feel bad about the sick days that I'm taking. I feel bad about my absenteeism. And it all good always became of that. I've never really had a bad employer that couldn't work with me and in my own mental issues that I was having. Mm-hmm. Quite on the contrary, Kathy K. McKinnon, which was the, her exact role, I believe I'm going to go ahead and say, anyway, she was the head of the operations at Fit for Less. I'm not great with titles. I apologize, Kathy, if she watches this. But she was amazing. She said, Dan, you know, I want to help you. I want to do whatever we can to have you stay because you're a valued member of this team. So I ended up working with HR, which was absolutely incredible. Great organization. Can't say enough about how they treat their employees. But at the end of the day, it was always me that I said, I'm not doing good enough right now. And that would in turn feed back into my anxiety. Then I would get anxious about, you know, me thinking I'm underperforming.
Yeah. You said that you always managed to get your work done in spite of how you were feeling.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I've always been somebody that's been very good at sort of, I guess, being efficient in the times where I felt quite productive. So in situations where I would go into work, I would go into work more often than I wouldn't. Yes. It might be, you know, one day every couple of weeks or a couple of days in a week or something like that, that I wouldn't. But I would be very proficient in getting my work done. and doing it well and making sure that, you know, supervisors signed off on it. And that's where art is kind of nice too, because I can sit at my desk and when I'm very focused, I can put in the effort and it looks really, really good. And as soon as I feel like, you know, it's not coming across, I can step away and come back anytime. Mm-hmm. So I've always been good at that. Even going back into my school days, honestly, I would have anxiety. I didn't realize this at the time, that this was a behavior that would carry forward into my professional careers. But I wouldn't go into class. Some days I would have a lot of anxiety. I didn't know it was anxiety at the time. But I would stay home and I would still learn on my own. I would still go online and say, okay, what am I missing? Sure, I'm going to get my class notes from other students, but what am I missing right now to make sure that I don't fall back? Because the actual missing of class would also contribute to my anxiety too.
Yes. How did it feel to disclose to your employer that you had mental health challenges?
Right now, I don't feel this way at all. But back then, it was very, very difficult. I didn't want to share with anyone. And, you know, even in the last few months, I'm sure my friends and family are like, oh, my God, Dan, you have anxiety. I had no idea. But like I said, I was always very, very good at faking it, giving off the impression of a pseudo extrovert, you know, a la Susan Cain in an amazing audiobook that changed my life. But it was very difficult disclosing that to employers. And the only one I ever really did disclose it to was, first of all, I call him my physio dad, Jim Millard. He was my mentor and my very first person that I began working with in physiotherapy out in Body Mechanics. I disclosed to him, you know, this is what I'm going through. I got teary eyed when I did it. I said, you might have noticed, you know, I'm not here as often, but this is what's happening. And he just gave me a hug. When I told Kathy this at Good Life, again, it was the same reaction. It was just sympathy, empathy, and trying to do whatever they can to help me. So though I was afraid to tell people and didn't want to, only good ever came of sharing. And that's why I'm in a position now where I have a little bit of a platform and I'm able to have these discussions with wonderful people like yourself, that I make sure to fully disclose my own mental uniqueness and try to advocate for others to do the same.
Dan, what do you think through those periods of time, you said you were good at faking it. What do you think people saw when they saw you?
I think they had the perception of somebody being extremely confident. One thing that they did at the end of the program for my master's of physiotherapy was they asked every student in the class, we ended up, I think, with 49 students at the end of it, to write one thing about each of your other classmates. And I still have that piece of paper and I wish I had it in front of me and I could say it, but I know the overwhelming majority of people said very, very confident, going to perform very well in his occupation. And so I think a lot of people looked at me, and I don't know if they were envious. I don't know if they thought that they could perform the same way, but they certainly saw something that wasn't true at all.
It amazes me the amount of energy it had to take on your part to be seen that way, put that out there, and what you were going through inside. That's pretty incredible in terms of the energy drain that must have been for you.
See, and this is why I love having these discussions, because I just assume that nobody has that kind of understanding, Jan. And just you bringing this up, that question alone, tells me that people get it. There's other people that can understand my mind. It took so much energy from me. Susan Cain calls it a restorative niche, where even when I got into the profession, I would have a very, very good appointment. We would have 20-minute appointments with our patients. And then I would have to sit in my office with the door closed 3 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever it took. Sometimes, I would be late attending to my next patient, just to sit there, door closed, put my head down, and just try to refocus, try to do something that would allow me to go into the next one and do the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I can certainly relate to that. And I know in one of my discussions, I was saying with someone, talking with someone about how I used to think to myself, what people see on the outside is not what's going on in the inside. And I would think, well, I should try and focus on what people see on the outside. And that's just where I'll put my attention, not in the, I'm not going to be able to do this. I'm not going to be able to put food on the table. It's a pretty scary thought, because at the same time, you know that you have responsibilities.
You think this way for so long, you end up forgetting about yourself. Or in my case, it all started in grade 7. I never really learned who I was the entire process. And I finally had to look in the mirror. And when I left physiotherapy, that's when I began my journey of learning more about who I am and trying to match myself to occupations that I thought I would be a better match for.
Now, did you reach out for professional help, Dan?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I consulted psychotherapists. I consulted social workers, psychiatry. I tried many different medications, with my doctors and worked really, really hard. Like, I did everything I could to stay in physiotherapy. This wasn't like an all of a sudden switch that I made. I remember an especially hard day when I came home and I just said, we got to go to the doctor. I said this to my wife, we got to go to the doctor. We got to do something. And I was prescribed medication at that time, and it helped a bit, but it only helps take the edge off a lot of the days, countless professional help. And then it wasn't until I went to a social worker that I really made some leaps and bounds. They asked the tough questions that at that time I was willing to answer honestly.
Yeah. You've mentioned your wife a few times. What impact has she had for you and on you over these years together?
My wife, Tracy, with an IE, I have to clarify, Tracy with an IE, she never lets that go. She's a rock. She's so independent and she's so strong. And in many ways, she's the opposite of me. But she's somebody that I've always been able to lean on, and she's never cared about my 93% average. She's never cared about me being a great artist. She thinks those things are great, but she's always just really loved me for me. And I've never felt afraid to be honest with her. I've never been afraid to, say to her, I think this isn't going to work with respect to my job, so I think I need a switch. And so a lot of people, I can sit here and say, follow your dreams, be true to yourself and just do what makes you happy. But if you don't have that strong social circle, it's so, so difficult. And I mentioned my wife a few times, but my mother as well, they've been absolutely instrumental in me getting to the point that I'm at.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you'd like to add about coping mechanisms or things that you've learned that might be helpful to others?
Yeah, first and foremost, it's nothing really specific. Just really talk. talk to people, because you might think in your own head, I'm so unique and I'm so messed up. Nobody's going to understand and being able to chat with me about this. That is not true. Just chatting with somebody else, somebody you trust, obviously, that can help a lot. You know, being able to lean on somebody and not just internalize everything like I did for years, it really does help a lot. But don't be afraid to even, you know, look up specific resources. I'm an advocate for Anxiety Canada because they offer a lot of different techniques and resources that I use to help me get through some really, really tough days and try to take steps towards, you know, improving my own self. But there's all kinds of resources that are available out there. And now, you know, with the move and social media and online presences for organizations, it's so much more readily accessible.
Mm-hmm. So look for resources and talk to people that you trust.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's all kinds of different individual coping mechanisms that you can use. You know, there's the thought process or the thought path, you know, because right away I would have a thought. Let's say I was at my physiotherapy job, you know, it would be a weekend. It would be a Saturday morning and I would have the thought of work pop into my head and instantly I would have anxiety. And I never knew why that was. So there's different ways working with paper and confronting your thoughts and confronting your processes to get to the root of why that is. It's like, okay, I have anxiety right now. Why do I have anxiety? It's like, okay, maybe I feel this way. Maybe this feeling comes from this feeling. And so there's different things like that. There's even simple things like, all these terms are going to escape me. Mindfulness, just sitting there, just focusing on breathing, you know, because it's easy for our minds to get away from us, to jump to the end of these long thought processes. So just focusing on breathing, just focusing on being in the present. There's all kinds of things that can really help, you know, not only in the over a long period of time, but even in the present as well.
Are you still on the journey?
Absolutely. I think this is always going to be a journey for me, trying to achieve happiness, because there are still days that I do have anxiety, 100%. I think that's just me. I've accepted it, that it is who I am. I'm not trying to get rid of anxiety, because it helps me in so many different ways. It helps me accomplish some of the special things that I'm able to accomplish, and it makes me who I am. But always there are things that I'm trying to help. You know, for example, right now, the thing that I'm balancing or trying to balance is perfectionism. you take a look at my art and people are like, wow, that's perfect. And I have that own struggle with it because I don't want it to be perfect. My brain wants it to be perfect, but me trying to improve who I am, I don't want it to be perfect. And not only that, but I want to be okay with it not being perfect, because a lot of people think perfectionism is a great thing, and it is, but it's also a double-edged sword. You know, it can get in the way of a lot of things. So I like to use my art as not only a therapy to feel good in the moment, but also a way to improve who I am. So I think it's always going to be a journey for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that's one of the things in life altogether, that we keep thinking we're going to arrive somewhere. And, you know, it's going to be, well, when I get out of school, when I get out of, you know, university, when I, you know, really am successful in my job, when I get, it's all these when I's, as opposed to focusing on the now and the present and, you know, accepting how we are as human beings, right?
Yeah. And I was definitely one of those people. I said, I have anxiety now in school, but it's going to be different when I get into the profession. I'm going to be more confident. I'm going to be a physiotherapist. Things are going to be better. I'm going to have money. And then it was, oh, you know, now that I'm in the profession, as soon as I master the profession, then I'll be happy. And that's, you know, it's something that I've never really thought about the way that you've put it, but yeah, it's just a constant journey. I'm not trying to achieve anything now. It's just, you know, how can I take a step forward each day?
Have you always been an artist?
I think at heart I have. I've never identified myself as an artist, simply because, again, people from a very, very young age told me artists are not successful. You cannot be successful as an artist. And that was always framed in the expectation that success is matched directly to financial gain. And so I never identified as an artist. I always said, I'm somebody who can draw. when I was, I keep referencing this, but you know, when I was 5 years old, my mom, she worked a lot of hours at Fanshawe College, and she, you know, sometimes she would pick me up from daycare, bring me back to the office as she works, she'd get me a Happy Meal, and I would sit there and I would draw Happy Meal toys. Just sitting at her desk. That's just what I chose to do. I wasn't always somebody that wanted to be outside. I liked to play on my Game Boy. I liked to draw. And then as years went on, people would always tell me, like, wow, that's really good. That's some good drawing. But I never thought in my own head that it would be something that I pursued as an occupation. And then when I got into high school, you know, I took my art classes and I didn't really like painting and I didn't like some of the other stuff they made you do. But every time it came to drawing, I had a lot of fun with it and I did really, really well. So it was never something that I really called myself. It was just something that was a hobby and it was on the back burner and I would break it out whenever I needed it. And when it got to the point where my anxiety got really, really bad and I was really, really feeling like a failure and I just had nothing else to turn to, I sat down and just drew for 8 hours straight and I came up with something better than I had ever made in my life. And that was sort of the start of it for me.
And how long ago was that, Dan?
That was back in, that was March 2018. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So we even know the month.
I do. I remember that because it was a time where I was coming out of the web development world too. And I had actually taken a minimum wage job at a local gym. And it was, I had a lot of time. It was part-time minimum wage. And I just, you know, I was feeling really inadequate at that time. And yeah, I remember that.
So did you have, during all these years of work, periods of unemployment?
Yes. That's tough to say because I incorporated my own web development business around the same time that I was a physiotherapist.
Okay.
So I had always been a business owner that I could always make money, a little bit of money if I really needed it. Mm-hmm. And then when I got into school, I'm doing a little bit of website development at the same time. But I wouldn't really say I had a formal job title where I was employed by somebody.
Okay. But you always had something on the go.
I always had something on the go. Yeah.
Do you see yourself in any way as an entrepreneur?
I used to call myself an entrepreneur, specifically when I was a physiotherapist, because like I mentioned, a lot of private physiotherapists were on entrepreneurs at the same time. That's how they went from making $80,000 a year to hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And so I thought that's what I should do as well. I never got to that point, always pursued it. But I think when I made the transition to a professor at Fanshawe, that's when I dropped that title altogether. I think I went and changed my LinkedIn profile at the same time. I'm not an entrepreneur. I'm not somebody that's chasing money anymore. I'm just not.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So do you feel that in a period of time you were chasing money?
I think so. Yeah. And I think that was tied in a lot with the inadequacy that I felt. You know, the ability to provide for my family is the ability to make money. And there was a time when I felt like I was never going to get to the point where I could, you know, afford a house and afford to have, you know, a child with my wife. And, you know, we're still working on those things now. And now they seem to be more achievable to us, you know, given the point that I'm at now, doing something a little bit more steady, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So back to March of 2018, is that what we said?
Yeah.
So that's about 2 years.
Yeah.
What did you do that day, that 8-hour day?
I drew. So my favorite TV show of all time is The Office. Absolutely love The Office.
Yes.
I've watched it over and over and over again, and I'm going to continue doing it. But I remember I would wake up in the morning for some of my physiotherapy days at 5 o'clock. I would start at 7. I'd wake up at 5 just so I could watch a couple episodes, because that was one of the mechanisms that my social worker and I identified as a coping mechanism, but also one that would kind of feed into the anxiety behavior. I would try to get the most out of my day as possible, not worrying about, you know, the anxiety and day that I had in front of me. So I'd wake up extra early just to feel like I was getting something out of my morning. And I always felt good watching The Office. So, and on that day in March, I drew my favorite character, which was Steve Carell as Prison Mike. And it turned out pretty good. And I shared it with some people and they liked it too.
What is it about The Office?
I just find it hilarious. I don't know. It's so funny. It's not for everybody. I showed it to my mom. I said, you got to watch it. She hated it, and that's fine. but it's just, the characters are just so funny and so relatable in so many ways. And it allowed a little bit of an escape for me.
Well, it's an interesting concept with The Office too, because they look at the camera.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe that's why we feel a little bit more related to it.
Yes, that's true. The mockumentary style.
Yeah. They're looking right at us, which is actually a lot of fun.
Yeah, I agree.
So then what happened? When I guess, should I leap to when did the sports thing happen?
I guess in that time, I'm working part-time in this gym, and I'm drawing these characters from The Office, and I'm sharing them with people, and people think, wow, these are really, really good. But at the same time, I'm sharing them online, and people can be very mean online. And I produce some drawings that people absolutely, really criticized very, very heavily. And, I would immediately with my brain connect that kind of criticism back to the days that I was told I'm never going to be able to succeed as an artist. So what I had in my mind moving forward was I'll continue to draw for my own benefit, and I'll share it with other people, hoping that they get some love out of it too. Mm-hmm. And if some people don't like it, that's okay. That's fine. And that was the first time, this is the first thing I ever did where I felt like I could continue doing something for myself. And people could say, I'm not good at it, but I could still love doing it. And so I continued with it, and I kept my position as the person working part-time in the gym. And it wasn't until September where I had an offer, well, it was slightly before September, where I had an offer from Fanshawe to come in as a professor and help out there. And I thought that was really, really going to work out for me because, I love working with young adults, in coaching volleyball. Mm-hmm. And it helped me tie in all this, knowledge that I had gained, because I was going to be teaching occupational therapy assistants and physiotherapy assistants. So I was really excited about that. And I will say, it did go well. But I wouldn't say I loved it. So during that time, I'm still drawing here and there. And then it did get to the point where I did, skip forward to July 2019, where I drew my favorite player of all time, Peter Forsberg. That's actually this guy back here.
Yeah.
It's one of the few originals that I still have left. And I shared it again, like I did with all my other Office drawings. But this time I found that the hockey fans just went crazy over it. They just absolutely loved it. And they said, can we see more? Can you draw this person? And can you draw this person? And I woke up one morning a few days after sharing it, and a social media rep from the NHL sent me a message and said, can we share it? I honestly was skeptical that it was real at first, but I said, oh my goodness, yes, I'm excited. Please do it. And then when it actually happened on a Friday afternoon, I won't forget it. My wife was out getting her nails done and I was at the gym killing time. It was 2 p.m. It was 2 p.m. And I saw it come up and I cried. I cried. I couldn't believe it.
Good for you.
Yeah. And I'm getting teary-eyed right now. And it was so, so cool to see my art on that level. Not only did I feel good doing it, but then it was also feeding other people's happiness, and it was giving back to me too. And so I kept drawing athletes, mostly hockey players, and people kept loving it. And more people came to see my art. And the whole while I keep telling myself, you know what, there could come a day where, I don't know, I can't draw anymore. Maybe I break my hand, or maybe the NHL is tired of sharing my stuff, or maybe people are just over art. And I always keep that in the back of my head, and just say, I keep doing this for you and get the most of it out every day and just love the ride. So it's just a completely 180 thought process for me and what I'm used to.
It sounds like a 180, Dan, because so much of your thought process before was projecting. And I think surely a big breakthrough for you was when you realized that it was okay to be criticized and that you weren't going to let it stop you.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Because you spent a lot of time, of course, in self-criticism. And now I think you're allowing yourself to say, you know what? You've got so much to offer. And all these eclectic things that you've done over the years have led you to being much more of a deep person, right?
Thank you. Yeah. Right? And, yeah. And people say, do you regret, you know, going into physio? Do you regret spending all that money? And I say, no, I don't. Not at all. Because I don't think I would have learned who I am. I don't think I would have the same appreciation and this maturity if I didn't go through that. Yeah. So I have no regrets at all.
Yeah, I totally believe that everything we do, it's a learning experience about ourselves, about others, about the world. It's all learning and things to be taken in and growing within. And I love that. I love eclectic backgrounds. There's something to be proud of to me. You should listen to my podcast with Jodie Simpson, because she's a great Londoner, and she has a portfolio career. And it's something that's well worth looking at, because that's what you've had. You've built a portfolio career, and all that goes into the process, and well, with you out your hands too. So, and that's the other thing. I'm so amazed that you can make that thought process come out your hands. Like, it's just incredible.
Yeah. And you were mentioning a little bit there that, you know, everything's kind of led to the art and the self-criticism and accepting it. And that's where I think like the art has just worked out to be a perfect thing for me, because like I said, people say, how do you make what you make? Like, how do you produce this while I produce this? And I tell people, I said, you know what? It's going to sound kind of sad, but when I look at my art and I'm doing it, I see all the things that are wrong with it.
Yes.
That's just me. I see all the things that are wrong with it. And I pick certain things, maybe 70% of them, to fix. And I purposely leave the rest. And that's just me accepting, you know, trying to be better, trying to, you know, just enjoy the process rather than the result.
Trying to be better by accepting all the permutations. It's kind of like
that's life. Right. that's right. I do get criticisms like, oh man, you left that jersey kind of undone there. You could have spent more time there. And I say, absolutely. Absolutely. I, you know what? That's a fair criticism. I could have done that.
Good for you. I love that. So Dan, of course, I have to ask you about the eyes, and sure. Just coincidentally, Steve Eiserman, that particular piece. I don't understand what you see that you can put the soul into the eyes.
I get that question a lot.
Of course.
And the one thing, and I try to explain it as best I can, my process, the people, but whoever I draw, I try to gain an understanding of who they are. And it sounds corny. I get it. It sounds very spiritualistic, but I try to gain an understanding of the person. I'll go watch videos, you know, and it just so happens I've watched a lot of hockey and I've seen a lot of hockey interviews. And so it comes a little bit easier for hockey players for me. But if it's like a dog that I don't know or a person or somebody like that, I gain as much information as I can about this person and really study their face. And sometimes when I'm drawing it, you know, my wife's made this comment, my face will mimic the expression that I'm drawing. And I don't even realize it. I don't even realize that it's happening. And so there's some other kind of connection between, you know, the reference photo that I'm looking at, you know, my own feeling in my face and what I'm drawing in front of me. But again, that I do allow my perfectionism to run free in the eyes. 100% I do.
Okay.
I don't let too many mistakes happen around the eyes, because that's when it's so crucial to capture the person that you are capturing. And so I spend a lot of time there. I always start there, because if it's not right, I can start over and not waste 20 hours. I can waste, you know, 4 hours. And I'm constantly analyzing and saying, does this look right? Does this look perfect? Does this look like the person? And if not, I just start over and I'm okay with that.
Yeah. Well, not to belabor it too much, other than it's not even that it looks like the person. It's just the way it looks into the, or the dog or the animal. It's sure. The way it just looks right into the soul of the person. And I just think that's fascinating from a viewer's point of view, from when I look at it and I think, wow, I can see the intensity of that individual. And of course, when you're at that level of sport, you're going to have a pretty intense expression at the best of times, and you you're going to be an intense person.
Yeah.
But it's just seeing that intensity is just so astounding to me. But at the same with the animals. I mean, you look at the animals and you think, wow, that animal, if I could have a conversation with him, I know I'd enjoy it.
No, that's good. But and then going back to, you know, Steve Yzerman specifically, you wanted to chat about him, in that one, when I saw the reference photo for it, that's what I saw. I saw intensity. I saw focus. You know, he's got blood on his nose, which is trickling down, and he's got sweat on the side of his face running over top of some scars. And his face tells you he doesn't even know that's happening. Yeah. You know, all he sees is what's happening in front of him on the ice. Mm-hmm. And he's thinking through to what would I do differently there? And how am I going to be different and change things when I get on the ice? Mm-hmm. And it just caught me so strongly. And I said, yeah, this is what I have to draw. This is what I have to capture.
Yeah. And I feel that we see the ice with him.
Yeah, you get the sense. You know, I get rid of the backgrounds all the time in my drawings. People say, wow, you should really draw the backgrounds and draw the fans and draw the boards. And but that's not what I try to do in my pieces. I try to draw the person, put the focus all on them. And then even when you take away the rink, even when you take away, sometimes it comes through in the reflections of the visors and whatnot, but even when you take away all that extra stuff, like you said, you know, you still feel like you're seeing what he's seeing, and you know where he is. So
yeah, thank you for saying that. I feel the picture, the scene beyond the drawing.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, definitely thank there you with them. And that too amazes me, that you see beyond what's on the page. I mean, that's surely, that is true art to put that into our minds. So.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, Jen. That means so much. Thank you.
So just tell me, on the business side of it, are you selling prints, or are you take commissions? Just tell me the business side a little bit.
So how it all started for me when I pursued all this, and I never approached it to make money, but when I first drew a couple of athletes, I think Tiger Woods was the first athlete I ever drew. It might have been Rory McIlroy, because he's a golfer that my wife calls her sports husband, and I'm okay with it. That's fine. I shared it, and people wanted copies. They just, I want this. And I said, okay, well, you know, what's it going to cost me to produce a print, and what's it going to cost me to ship it? That's what you're going to give me, right? I'm not doing this to make money. And so I would start there, but it wasn't until I did a few of those, and then somebody else approached me and they wanted something custom done. They wanted their dog drawn. And I said, oh, I don't know, give me a donation, right? I don't do this for money. Give me a donation. Of course, I'm still doing other jobs at the time. And so I would do commissions for them. And then as time went on, more and more people wanted commissions. And so then I had to change my pricing, and I had to change that around. And, yeah, and then so And then it got to the point where, once I started drawing hockey players, I was able to, sell prints of those. And then other people wanted more and more commissions. And then it got to the point where I had to stop commissions because I had too many requests. And so that's kind of the model that I'm in right now. I do sell some prints, and I do some commissions, but very, very selective. And there is unfortunately a little bit of a wait for some people.
I hope you realize, Dan, that we want you to have an economic return on this art, because that way you can keep doing this incredible work. But if there's anything at all in your mind that you're not deserving of money in any way, that doesn't make sense to me. This is your business. We're just blessed with your talent, and you're blessed with your talent, and that comes with its pros and cons.
Thank you.
With that kind of talent, you know, we want you to earn money, and we're proud of you as a Londoner that's got this incredible voice, really. That's what's coming through your work. So
thank you. Yes.
So yes, never doubt that the rest of us want you to do well.
Well, I think that, I have had a few people earlier on in my career, and, you know, I've quoted them prices for custom pieces and stuff. And they're like, wow, that's ridiculous. I would never charge that much for a doodle. And my dad, he was always number one to come to me, and, you know, he focuses on the money side of things. He's like, son, this is what you're worth. So that is what you charge. That's it. And I was like, oh my God, I don't see that worth yet. And I'm starting to see it more and more. And my wife is getting involved with the business and administration side of things. And you know, so I actually let other people handle a lot of that, but But, you know, I get people, we just opened up at the fair again here in London, and I get people coming by and they say, you charge too little. Mm-hmm. You just tell me, they're like, honestly, you charge too little. This should be a lot more. Yes. So I'm trying to find that balance between, you know, being affordable to people because I don't want price to be an obstacle for my art, but also, you know, trying to respect myself.
Yeah. It's an interesting balance, I think, between the business and the art. It's yeah. always a bit of a push and a pull.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Is there anything before we wrap up that you would like to add, Dan? Anything you'd like to say?
I mean, there's lots that I'd love to say, but I think at the end of the day, if you're somebody who is struggling mentally, you know, whether it's something that you realize is anxiety or you don't realize what it is, you feel something's wrong and you're feeling like, you know, things aren't going to turn around for you. Just understand that there are other people. There's thousands of people that are there right now and you have no idea, and they don't let anyone else have an idea either. And it is up to you to decide, you know, whether or not you want to seek the help, because it's there. I promise you it is there. And there are steps that we can all take to improve who we are and start taking a step towards improving our happiness, not trying to achieve happiness, but improve it. And just know, honestly, like, you're not alone. I've felt alone many times. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I started telling other people that I didn't feel alone anymore. So, yeah. Stay strong. If you have to grind it out doing what you're doing at your current job, I respect that. It takes a ton of strength, but don't be afraid to work on yourself at the same time.
Yeah. Dan, what is your website so people can look at your art?
So you can, there's two different places that you can go. You can go to petonsart.ca to see my actual website, learn more about who I am. It takes a lot of updating. I still have to do, but you can also go to petonsart.etsy.com to see all my current works available for purchase.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you for chatting with me today.
Thanks for having me, Jan. It was a wonderful discussion.
Yeah, amazing discussion. To our viewers and listeners, thanks so much for joining Dan and me today through quite an incredible discussion of an amazingly strong person. And sometimes I, you know, just get the impression Dan doesn't realize just how strong he is. So to our viewers and listeners, I hope that you've enjoyed this discussion. Do take a look at the art. It is absolutely astounding. And right from London, Ontario, Canada. So we're very proud of our London native here. So do follow us on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts, and also reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'd love to connect with you. So thanks for being with us today, and until we meet again.